Bønne. John chapter 11 and verse 1 says, "Now a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sister sent word to Jesus, 'Lord, the one you love is sick.' And when he heard this, Jesus said, 'This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it.' Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. And then he said to his disciples, 'Let us go back to Judea.' 'But Rabbi,' they said, 'a short while ago the Jews there tried to stone you, and yet you are going back?' Jesus answered, 'Are there not 12 hours of daylight? Anyone who walks in the daytime will not stumble, for they see by this world's light. It is when a person walks at night that they stumble, for they have no light.' After he'd said this, he went on to tell them, 'Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going there to wake him up.' His disciples replied, 'Lord, if he sleeps, he will get better.' Jesus had been speaking of his death, but his disciples thought he meant natural sleep. So then he told them plainly, 'Lazarus is dead, and for your sake, I'm glad I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him.' Then Thomas, also known as Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, 'Let us go, that we may also die with him.' On his arrival, Jesus found Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. 'Lord,' Martha said to Jesus, 'if you'd have been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask.' Jesus said to her, 'Your brother will rise again.' Martha answered, 'I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day.' Jesus said, 'I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this?' 'Yes, Lord,' she replied. 'I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who has come into the world.' After she'd said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. 'The teacher is here,' she said, 'and is asking for you.' When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house, comforting her, noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, 'Lord, if you'd have been here, my brother would not have died.' When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who'd come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. 'Where have you laid him?' he asked. 'Come and see, Lord,' they replied. Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, 'See how he loved him.' But some of them said, 'Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?' Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. 'Take away the stone,' he said. 'But Lord,' said Martha, the sister of the dead man, 'by this time there's a bad odor, for he's been in there 4 days.' Then Jesus said, 'Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?' So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, 'Father, I thank you that you've heard me. I know that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me.' When he said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, 'Lazarus, come out.' The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, 'Take off the grave clothes and let him go.' Therefore, many of the Jews who'd come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. 'What are we accomplishing?' they asked. 'Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation.' Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than the whole nation perish. He did not say this on his own, but as the high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. Therefore, Jesus no longer moved about publicly among the people of Judea. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the wilderness, to a village called Ephraim, where he stayed with his disciples. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, many went up from the country to Jerusalem for their ceremonial cleansing before the Passover. They kept looking for Jesus, and as they stood in the temple courts, they asked one another, "What do you think? Isn't he coming to the festival at all?" But the chief priests and Pharisees had given orders that anyone who found out where Jesus was should report it so that they might arrest him. There was a lot of Bible. We've talked over the last few weeks about transformation, and very particularly in the last couple of weeks, I've talked to you about our need of him. And the necessity to recognize I need him. And last week I spoke to you about the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus' interaction with Philip, and the fact that he highlights the impossible situation to demonstrate your need of him. So we've got this story of two sisters who are crystal clear they need Jesus. Lazarus is sick, and they send word for Jesus. They need him to come and move into that situation. It's clear Lazarus is very unwell, as demonstrated by the fact that he ends up dead. And it's clear that the sisters expected things could be different if Jesus had come in their time frame. Lord, if you'd have been here, my brother would not have died. It's what both of them say, verse 21 and verse 32. They didn't lack faith that Jesus could transform the situation. They recognized they needed him in the situation to bring transformation. They've sent word and called upon him. They believe he has the capacity to work miracles, but Lazarus dies anyway. And I guess I have a view that one of the most challenging things for us as Christians is when we think we've done the right thing in the situation and we're looking at the wrong result. When we think we've done the right thing. They've called on Jesus. They knew they needed him. Lazarus is seriously sick. And yet they end up burying their brother. This isn't how it's supposed to be, surely. And what we want to know is, what's the formula? How do we get what we think we need, when we think we need it, how we think we need it? How do I get out of this situation what I want? Lazarus is seriously sick. And Jesus loves Lazarus. He's worked many miracles to heal seriously sick people already. And Mary and Martha recognize their need of Jesus and call on him. Surely that should equate to a transformation in Lazarus' situation. You would assume that Jesus, with great haste, might get up and rush to the one who's sick, who he loves. But instead, Jesus waits until he knows Lazarus is dead before leaving. And I think one of the challenges for us in life is I want to understand how I get God to do what I want him to do. I want him to act as I want him to, when I want him to, how I want him to. And I want to know the formula to make him do that. But John 11 and verse 6 says something really strange. Verse 5 says, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Verse 6 says, so when he heard Lazarus was sick, he stayed 2 more days. Therefore, he stayed 2 more days. He loves them, so he stays. That doesn't work for me, really. See, I think love and urgency go hand in hand. Right? If I need you and you love me, I expect you to come quickly. It's a desperate situation that in 2 days' time is going to lead to death. And because Jesus loves him, he waits till he dies. All right, okay. And by the time Jesus arrives, he's not only dead, he's buried, his body's decomposing in the tomb. And you have that famous phrase in the King James, he stinketh. But his waiting wasn't an absence of care or concern for Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. It's apparently entirely the opposite. And I need to be careful that my measure of God's love for me is not his willingness to do what I want him to do, when I want him to do it, how I want him to do it. Because apparently, the way this unfolds is far bigger than that immediate family. It's an impossible situation. Lazarus is lying in the tomb. His body's decomposing. He's been in there 4 days. The 4 days matters because some superstitious Jews believe that the body hung on to the soul a little bit for 3 days. So by 4 days, he's definitely dead. And Jesus goes, and in going, tells the disciples, for your sake, I'm glad I wasn't there. This is now not just about Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. It's also about the disciples. Because for your sake, I'm glad I wasn't there, so that you may believe. He's already conscious about what's going to happen in this situation. And he's going to teach his disciples something through the scenario of people outside of that immediate circle. So this isn't just about them. But verse 45 also tells us many Jews believed because of what Jesus did. So there's a whole host of people now whose lives have been impacted by one man being sick. But Jesus is crystal clear from the outset. In verse 4, Lazarus' sickness has a purpose. It is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it. It is for God's glory so that God's Son may be glorified through it. I read a lot of Bible to you. But it's really important that you capture the full story of this. Because Lazarus' death and resurrection is the catalyst for the cross. Lazarus' death and resurrection is the catalyst for the cross. In response to the reports of the Jews who saw Jesus call Lazarus out of a grave, the chief priests and Pharisees call a meeting of the Sanhedrin. That's verse 47. They were afraid, on account of the signs that he'd done, that everyone might believe in him. And that would cause problems for them politically and religiously. That's verse 48. So Caiaphas, the high priest, has a prophetic word. Caiaphas, the high priest, has a prophetic word. That it's better for one man to die than a whole nation to perish. God speaks through Caiaphas in the Sanhedrin. That it's better for one man to die than a whole nation to perish. And verse 53 says this thing. So from that day on, they plotted to kill him. Verse 56, they kept looking for Jesus, and as they stood in the temple courts, they asked one another, what do you think? Isn't he coming to the festival at all? But the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that anyone who found out where Jesus was should report it so that they might arrest him. They've got a plan now. This is Jesus' last miracle before he is crucified. It is the thing that leads to the cross. It's not that Jesus didn't love Lazarus. It's not that he was inconsiderate. It's that actually the purpose that he was working out in this situation was far bigger than Mary, Martha, or Lazarus would ever begin to comprehend. All of human history was going to change because of what happens in those moments. So why does that matter to us? Because I live in a very Josh-centered world. Right? And you live in a very you-centered world. And what goes on in your life, you feel the strain of. You feel the pain of. And it's easy to assume that it's in isolation to everything else. It's easy to see your life in a way that assumes, well, if God loved me, he would do something about this situation right now. Without any recognition that your life and what happens in it impacts other people. It mattered that Jesus didn't go straight away to heal Lazarus, that he didn't send his word like he'd done in other situations, that he didn't act in the moment when they wanted it, how they wanted it. For the disciples' sake, that they may believe. I don't ever think about you when I'm going through stuff. I mean that in the nicest way possible. But my consideration is not, oh, I wonder what Brian will see in me as a result of this. It's, I wonder what God might teach everybody else while I walk through this challenge. That's not what I think. I live in a Josh-centered world. I don't like it. I want it to change. Do it now, God. teach somebody else through somebody else. Right? That's my heart at times. I don't like it. I want it to change. Do it now. And God might be revealing things to people within the church through what you walk through. But he might be calling people to himself through what you walk through as well. Because many Jews come to believe. And God might be fulfilling his eternal purpose in the earth through what you walk through. But I want him to do in my life what I want right now. They don't both work. And the truth is, many of us want God to use our lives and for our lives to have impact and meaning and importance. Let me ask it this way. Are you willing to be sick and die for the sake of all of human history? Because that's Lazarus's purpose in the cross. That people would witness the miraculous power of Jesus through his suffering. And as a result, determine, we're going to kill that guy. In my Josh-centered world, what I want to know very often is how I get God to do what I want him to do, when I want him to do it, and how I want him to do it. That's what I want, right? I want to be able to say to him, Lord, I feel this. I want to take the 3 steps that I need to take. Say the prayer I need to pray. You know, if I need to fast, I'm willing to do it. But whatever it is that gets me to the result that I want out of this is the thing I'm looking for. Very rarely when I'm walking through challenging situations do I ask myself the question, God, what are you doing to achieve your purpose here? I don't begin to understand the complexity of life, the nature in which our lives are intertwined, the impact my life has on yours, the way those things work together, and the fact that he is making all things work together for good for all of those who love God and are called according to his purpose. This is bigger than just me. This has to be bigger than just me. And his commitment is to work all things together for good in your life. But you might be a grieving sister saying, Lord, if you'd have been here, it would have been different, without recognizing actually you're going to fulfill a purpose that you began in Genesis chapter 3. You're doing something that you spoke of thousands of years before. And we've been thinking about transformation. And we would be transformed by the renewing of our mind. And I'm suggesting to you that one of those issues might be to recognize your life has never lived in isolation. That what God does in and through you matters not only to you, but to people around you, to those watching your life, to those who don't know him yet. And it has a part to play in the eternal purposes of God. And it's far too easy to get frustrated that it doesn't look how you want it to look right now. And it's far too easy to be disappointed that it hasn't worked out the way you expected it to work out at this stage right now. And never recognize this is bigger than just me. It must have been amazing. To stand around and watch as a guy who's been dead for 4 days and in a tomb just comes wandering out when Jesus says, Lazarus, come forth. That must be incredible, right? It must be utterly astounding. But had it been up to the sisters, the stone would still be in front of the grave. Had it been up to them, Jesus, he smells. And his smelliness and the mess of that wasn't worth exposing. It's not always pretty. And very often, for God to do the impossible, the situation has to look pretty dire. It might stink. And the truth is, I think Mary and Martha are already disappointed. If you had have been here, it would have been different. But you weren't, so it's not. They're disappointed. Jesus, as far as I'm concerned, tells Martha exactly what you would want to hear in the situation where your brother is dead. Your brother will live again. She does what I think most of us Christians do when we're disappointed. Finds a theological way to resolve what Jesus has said to her that doesn't change the immediate circumstances. I know he will live again at the resurrection and the last. I found a way to make the Bible work for my situation right now. I found a way to make this convenient to what I believe in this moment because I'm disappointed. You mustn't be doing something here, so I'll just abandon that. And when you tell me the thing I want to hear, I'll find a way to make it work with my current circumstance. But the messiness of it, their disappointment, none of it changes his ability to transform the situation. And I think it's important for us in our me-centered worlds where really what we want from God sometimes is to do exactly what we want him to do, when we want him to do, how we want him to do it. is to get past ourselves, to trust that he's at work, to have confidence that he is bringing to completion the thing that he started. Jesus' testimony about his father in John 5:17 is, "My father is always at work." And I might be disappointed with the way my circumstances look right now. And I might be in distress because Jesus hasn't come to heal a situation when I wanted him to, how I wanted him to. But he might be doing it because he loves you. Lazarus, forgive me for saying it like this, is going to die at some point anyway. So Jesus could heal him. But unless he goes to the cross, then no way is made. It is in the death and resurrection of Jesus that death is defeated. That I am given access to the Father. It is because he died that I can be saved, that I am justified before God, that I have the promise of eternal glorification. I think that matters more than extending Lazarus's life by a few years. But he does both. And then there's this really weird bit of the story, I think. Jesus knows from the outset, when he's told Lazarus is sick, that through this sickness, God is going to glorify himself and his son. He tells the disciples when they're like, "Oh, well, if he's sleeping, he'll get better. Don't worry about it. We'll be okay. Lazarus is dead, and for your sake, I'm glad I wasn't there, so that you may believe." He gets to the situation and is asked, and asks the sisters, "Take me to the grave." I have no question Jesus knew what he was going to do. I have no question that Jesus knew that he was going to call Lazarus out of the grave. Resurrected. I have no doubt in my mind. You might, and that's okay. But when he gets to the grave, he cries. He knows what's going to happen. He knows it's all going to be okay in the end. He knows how this works out. Yet he still feels it. The one who he loves is in a grave, dead. He knows he's about to call him out. But he cries anyway. It's easy to think that God, working out his eternal purposes, with Jesus up there sitting next to him, they know what's going to happen, so it's all right for them. It's all right for them. I'm going to suggest to you that you have a high priest who sympathizes with your weaknesses. I think that's the Bible. I have a Father in heaven who bottles my tears, who's acknowledging every difficult circumstance I'm walking through, who sees my pain, and is not absent or distant in it, but he is near to the brokenhearted and those who are crushed in spirit. And it doesn't matter that he knows what's going to happen next. He's not emotionless in the moment. He cries. The shortest Bible verse, Jesus wept. So in my me-centered world, where I want God to do what I want, when I want, how I want, I think I need to acknowledge it might be bigger than me. He might be doing more than I recognize right now. He might be doing something far greater than I have the ability to comprehend in these circumstances. You don't look at your brother lying in a tomb as two grieving sisters and assume, well, this will be the way that Jesus ends up on a cross to save all of humanity. But I also think I need to recognize that just because he's not doing exactly what I want, when I want, how I want, it doesn't mean he doesn't care about how I feel. I think it's worth considering, because I've been around church a little while. I've seen some people walk through some stuff. And very often their frustration is, how do I get the formula right to get God to do what I want him to do? Let me remind you of the initial outbreak of COVID when we were all locked in our homes. The Bible verse I heard most at that time: if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will heal their land. It's what everybody wanted to say. Why? Because it was a formula to solve the situation. If we all just prayed, maybe COVID would disappear. There was a lot of church that wanted to just talk about the fact that if we would all just pray, it might transform everything. But you can call on him, and he might still have different purpose than what you think. So as I pursue him and ask him to transform me, I need to get comfortable with the fact that he might wait because he loves me. That he might not do what I want when I want because he loves me. That he might not respond in the way I ask him to when I ask him to because he loves me. Should we stand together and worship?